Not really. You kind of covered it. Wales, table tennis, women, basketball, video games, school. I love Pokemon cards, but that falls into the nerd stuff you were saying. So I still love Pokemon cards. Me and my best friend from growing up, like whenever we see each other, which this will be this weekend, by the way, I'm going home. We will be playing Pokemon. That is just what happens. That card game is lit, and I don't care what anybody says. I'm a grown man. I don't stand by it. I will wipe the floor with any child that thinks they know what they're doing.
Hello, this is Deborah Anderson, the Black Woman Animator, coming back to you with another video. And in this video, I have Brennan Edwards. Welcome.
Hey, yourself. Yes, of course. Well, you said my name correctly. It is Brennan Edwards. I am the CEO and founder of Transit Pictures and the president and one of the founders of Kevin on Stage Studio. Silent snaps.
Yeah, I'm not trying to, you know, do too much.
Okay.
Just the visual, you know what I'm saying? So, we are both from Michigan, and we are both twins.
Wow.
I found that last tidbit out by accident.
How'd you find out we're twins by accident?
Because I was watching the Honeydew List, and I was looking up your brother, and then I found out y'all were twins.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I didn't realize that was your brother watching the episode, but you know how you just be Googling when you're watching TV, and then it's like, oh, okay.
That's awesome. Well, that's just crazy to me. So, like, when you looked him up, what did you find?
Just the music, because they mentioned the music piece on the show, I think. And so I just was like, oh, let me go listen to him music.
did you like it? Was it good? Was it terrible?
Yes, it was. Actually, on your on one of your many YouTube channels, I found an old video of him singing John Legend somewhere in Detroit.
So. Oh, wow. You really dug on him. Okay. Yeah, that's
no, old. That was like, that was looking up you, and it was on like your YouTube channel. So
okay, cool.
Yeah,
but yeah, he's a singer. If anybody wants to look him up, it's under Symmetry, Symmitre. That is his artist name, and he is very talented. You know, and I am biased, but I also would tell him if he was trash. I would tell you if he was trash too, because
I feel like that's a thing. Because like my brother is like really good. Like I have talked crap on my brother, but my brother is really good at comedy and acting. Like when we were in high school, he was in A Midsummer Night's Dream, and he's the only person I understood because he, I guess, embodied the character, so the Shakespearean accent didn't matter. But I didn't know what nobody else was saying but him.
Yeah, I don't understand Shakespearean anything. I can't watch it. I'm just like sitting there, just like, oh, okay, it looks like they're fighting. Yeah, they're fighting. Okay, cool. You
know. Cool. So you are from Grand Blanc, Michigan. How was it growing up? What is your origin story?
Oh, well, first of all, I'm going to make fun because you're reading it. I saw that. But yes, I am from Grand Blanc. And it was cool, man. I like Grand Blanc. I tell people that it was like a utopia of sorts. I think I was very privileged growing up. Is that, you know, Grand Blanc is a majority, you know, white school. But it's a really big school. I graduated with like 600 people. And I think 8 or 10% was black. Which sounds like not a lot, but when you have 600 kids, you know, times four,
yeah,
that's 2,400 kids, you get 10%, you know, that's more than one lunch table. You know what I'm saying? At lunch. You know, that is a whole culture and population.
Yeah.
And so, like, we had a good time, you know, and there was that. And then also, like, I went to the same school system since I was in preschool. And I have an older sister that ended up being, like, a valedictorian. So she was, like, the example setter. So, mm-hmm. All the teachers and all the administrators knew who my brother and I were. We were also the black twins. You know what I'm saying? So everybody knew who we were, and we had a good reputation coming in. So we didn't really have to deal with, like, direct institutional racism like that, you know, growing up, because we were just, like, we were the golden children. We were super cool. Everybody liked us. You know, I ended up being, like, on the homecoming royalty, you know, when I was in high school. And so just, like, I had a really good time. You know, I had a rude cultural awakening when I went to college, but up in high school and stuff like that, man, it was a good time.
Mm-hmm. What kind of twins are you all? Like, are y'all the close twins, supportive twins, like the normal twins, or are y'all the offshoot where you're like...
I mean, I don't know what type of normal twins there are. Like, my brother and I are like opposite.
Mm-hmm.
But we attract because of that. We get along really well. He's super artistic. I'm really about you know, I'm very much about my business, you know, so I've always been in that way, like business guy. And I'm a people person, you know, he's pretty introverted. So we always got along. My brother and I don't think have ever actually had like a real fight before. You know, we wrestled and fought like for fun all the time, mm-hmm. but we never really got super mad at each other. So we're close. Like he even came off to LA a year after I did to be here around me. And he also, you know, we lived together for a few years out here in LA. And, you know, I don't know how we could be closer. It's pretty great.
Yeah, he was supposed to come move out with you, but he got an opportunity. So he
didn't. Yeah, he was supposed to move out with me, but he got an opportunity working in music, and then he couldn't come. Man, you and your research. Okay, sorry. But yes, he got an opportunity to work in the music industry with a guy named Troy Taylor, nice. Who's big in the industry. So he did that, and then I wanted to come here. The original idea was we were both going to come together. Got the opportunity, so I just came out by myself a year later.
I said I wanted to set up the twinness, like y'all were going to move out here, but it didn't work out.
You know? It didn't work out, but it all ends up as it's supposed to. You know, I needed that year. I needed to get that year to start, you know, forging the path to be able to make it so he had a landing spot as well. You know,
yeah,
it was all good.
So, you wanted to be a marine biologist when you were younger. What happened to that dream?
Oh, how you want to ask about my dash dream? Okay. Well, that all got started because I remember asking about when I was in elementary school, I remember asking a teacher like, yo, what is the biggest animal to ever exist? And my teacher was like, a blue whale. And I was like, oh, when did those live? When did those exist? And they were like, they're around today. And I was just like, I'm sorry, what? They're bigger than dinosaurs? Oh yes. Much bigger than dinosaurs. Bigger than brontosaurus. Like, oh yeah. Bigger than that too. And I was like, how big? And then she's like, well, bigger than this classroom. I was like, bigger than this classroom? Yes. Roughly the size of this whole hallway in the school. And I'm just like, what? And so then I just started to do more research. Back then, research required going to a library and getting books. Right. And so, you know, because I'm old. And so.
Dewey Decimal System and everything.
I remember learning the Dewey Decimal System in elementary school, but never actually having to use it. Because by the time we were allowed to go to the library, there was computers that you could just type in a word and it would tell you where the book was. So I was just like, I never had to, like, they're like, here's the Dewey Decimal System. And we were all like, why? They're like, you know, good point. You actually don't need to know this.
Right.
I think we were the first class not to need the Dewey Decimal System. But either way.
On the cutting edge.
Yeah, that was, right? It's like we first class to have computers in the classroom and stuff. But I ended up just becoming obsessed. The more you learn about whales, the more interesting they become. You know, you learn that there's like two different types of whales. You know, you learn about porpoises. You learn about dolphins. You learn about how they breathe. Their noses are on their head. You learn that they used to be land animals. They still have fingers under their flippers. You know, you're just like, holy crap. And you also learn like they have complex cultures and languages that we still can't even decipher because they're so much more complex than we are. We learn about how intellect is judged by humanity. We say that it's the difference, you know, we judge your intelligence as a creature based upon the synapses and the connections between them in your brain.
Yeah.
And I never can remember which one, but whales have more of one of them than we do, and we have more of the other. I think we have more synapses, but they have significantly more connections between them. And so that means that their brain works more efficiently, has better communication across them. No. But we do know that their language is so complex that we've just recently, I think a few years ago, there's a marine biologist off of the United UK in the UK that learned the different names for different dolphins and is able to call dolphins in the wild by their name, you know, playing the sound underwater, and a dolphin will be like, what's up? They'll come up like, yeah, me? Yeah, what you want? You want me? And so we've learned. It's like, okay, they have names. And so it's
nice.
Like, holy shit, they have names, which means they have a lot more. They make clicks, whistles, blows, kind of sounds underwater, as well as have body language. And so if all that is happening and they're having these levels of conversation underwater, and also, if you look at something like orcas, killer whales, that have the ability to kill literally anything in the sea, they are the apex predators of the entire ocean. Mm-hmm. Like, they could hunt everything in the ocean to extinction if they wanted to. They're like, you know what? Ain't gonna be no more white sharks, great white sharks. There wouldn't be any more. So it's just, for me, it's just really interesting just to learn more and more about that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I'll nerd out. I didn't become a marine biologist, but I am still a citizen scientist in the space of, like, I never stop learning more and more about whales. But you want to know how my dream was dashed, because that was a terrible, thwarted, mean question. No, I mean, it wasn't necessarily thwarted. It's just like, I
look at, because you are a citizen scientist currently, right?
I love it, yes. But the reason it didn't, the reason I didn't go after that as a career path is because one day I was walking through the hall, the principal of my high school just was like, you know what, Brennan, I know you, but I've never really sat down and had a conversation with you. Normally I only talk to the kids who get in trouble, and I wasn't one of them. Do you mind? I was like, are you going to give me a hall pass to my class so I'm not late? He's like, yes. I was like, okay. So we went and sat down and we were talking, and he's like, man, you're one of the more popular kids in the school. Like, you kind of just cross between all the different groups. You get along with everybody. You seem to really enjoy people and all that kind of stuff. What do you want to do with your life? And I was like, I want to be a marine biologist. He was just like, okay. I was like, what? He's like, let's have the conversation. I was like, well, what do you mean? He was just like, he did it. He was trying to be really nice, but he's just like, let me ask you a few questions for sure. He's like, all right, so where do you think a marine biologist lives? I was like, on the beach? And he was just like, kinda. A lot of marine biologists live on boats. I was like, I like boats. He's like, all right, that's cool. He's like, do you like people? I was like, I love people. He's like, I know. He's like, how many new people do you think you're going to meet and interact with on a boat? And I was like, not very many. He's like, no, not very many. So you can definitely be a marine biologist. You could do that. But I think you also love people a lot. So I think you might have a choice to make. Like, do you want to be working with a lot of people that you get to meet new and exciting people every day? Or do you want to be working with, you know, whales on a boat every day? And I was just like, the pain. And I ended up choosing people. And that's the reason why I moved away from being a marine biologist. I was like, okay, fine. I don't need to be that. I can still love whales without having to be a marine biologist. So I made that choice.
Nice.
There, you happy?
I'm glad you had a support system and, you know, they directed you. It wasn't like the, you know, because you said you had that privilege, so it wasn't like that, oh, you can't be that. It just was like, well, you know, I'm looking at what you are interested in, and maybe you won't like that. I like that.
I'm looking at the raw skills and talent in front of me, and they do not say marine biologist. Well, you're smart enough for sure, but not many people are as good with people as you are. Mm-hmm. It's like, fine, you know?
I'll be a people person. Mm-hmm. So you were obsessed with, you know, video games and comic books and basketball when you were younger. Did you have any other interests?
Women? What you ask? I'm just like, yo, you covered most of the interests that I had. I love my friends. I love being throwing parties, and I love women. I was like, yo, women are amazing.
Women.
I was about it, you know. Trying to think. Well, I played table tennis competitively growing up.
Oh, wow. That's
so nice. That, yeah, was pretty good. And trying to think, anything else? Not really. You kind of covered it. Whales, table tennis, women, basketball, video games, school. I love Pokemon cards, but that falls into the nerd stuff you were saying. So I still love Pokemon cards. Me and my best friend from growing up, like, whenever we see each other, which this will be this weekend, by the way, I'm going home, we will be playing Pokemon. That is just what happens. That card game is lit, and I don't care what anybody says. I'm a grown man. I'll stand by it. I will wipe the floor with any child that thinks they know what they're doing.
Another thing we have in common, we both hurt our knees twice in high school, but I didn't hurt my knee as bad as you did. So
my knees? What you talking about? I got golden knees, man. Ain't nothing wrong with my knees. You don't know what you're talking about. I'll jump out the gym right now.
All right. Like, you tore your ACL. Like, oh.
Twice.
I just, like, you know, the first time my junior year, because I played 4 years varsity, so, like, my junior year,
Let's rewind that. You played 4 years varsity basketball?
Yes.
You're probably pretty good.
You know, I mean, I'm out of shape right now, but underneath.
You were good at football. Did you play in college?
So I went to Rochester Institute of Technology in Rochester, New York, because, you know, being from Michigan, there's a Rochester, Michigan, so you got to say the whole thing. I went there because I wanted to study animation and play basketball, so I could only pick RIT, SCAD, and, like, St. Clair College, which is in Canada. Went, like, okay, so I was supposed to do the little summer workout stuff. Didn't do it. Had a meeting with the coach and the captain. They knew I didn't do it. And we had a group, like, a team meeting. The coach called me out when she, like, oh, did you do your summer workout? Like, you know I didn't do it. Why are you doing this? Why are you being provocative? Right. So after that, I was like, I don't like the coach. this is D3, so it's traveling intramurals anyway. I'm out. So I was planning on playing in college. I didn't get recruited or anything. But
what position?
All of them, but mostly the 2 and the 3.
Okay, got you. I only had one choice when I played. So. I'm 5'7", man. I have one choice. So like, you're the point. Like, but I can shoot. That's cool. You're a shooting point guard. Like, okay.
Right.
Yeah. You know?
So, what would you say is your cultural makeup? That's not to say what's your ethnicity, or only to say what's your ethnicity, but what is the culture of where you grew up and the uniqueness of where you're from?
Hmm. So, obviously, I'm Midwest. Black as fuck. But I also grew up in a white community in a black neighborhood. So I think it's a pretty good juxtaposition. I grew up in a black church, but like I said, my neighborhood that I grew up in, the white kids jokingly and racistly used to call Little Africa, because a lot of the black families in Grand Blanc all lived in the same neighborhood. And it was a massive, nice neighborhood. I love that neighborhood. I'm going to be there tomorrow. I actually have a tattoo right here of this neighbor. That's this neighborhood tattoo right here. Boom. That's what that represents. Cause that's how much I love the neighborhood I grew up in and the people who I grew up around. And so for me, I had a really diverse childhood because also, as you know, Michigan is known for the auto industry, which brings a lot of engineers, which means there's a lot of Middle Eastern and Indian people that are there. And so we got to have all the greatest Middle Eastern Indian food and a bunch of friends like that too. And so I had a pretty diverse upbringing when it came to all those things. And I had a great time with that. So I'd say culturally, if you hear me talk to you on the phone, if you're not black, you probably think I'm white. If you are black and you think, if you are black, you probably pick up on it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like most black people pick up on it pretty quick. Like, oh yeah, that's a brother. You know, like there's certain things that I say that work like that, but it's not blatantly obvious.
Right.
My father grew up on a farm in Virginia. So I spent a lot of time as a kid on that, you know, going to visit my grandparents on that farm, in the country. Not country at all, but have been very much so exposed to the country. And now I'm saying I love my family. That's my fam. I love them. Even when I go down there, I pick up an accent a little bit randomly, which I don't intend to do. I assimilate wherever I go.
Yeah.
And so I would say that's my cultural makeup, is that I am, you know, base black man. Grew up in went to a white institution that was very tolerant and accepting, I would argue. There was definitely some issues, but definitely overall, like as an adult looking back, I'm just like, I think I had a pretty good time. But also had the black culture from my church and from my neighborhood and from my family. I got the countryside. I got the Midwest side. I didn't have to, code switching was something I had to learn how to do as an adult.
Yeah.
I would say that it's like, as a kid, it wasn't really a thing I really worried about. Because I was always with my black friends. And then when I was in school, it just didn't matter. Like nobody really cared. So I try to bring a piece of my childhood to every day so that people can enjoy life as much as I got to.
In college, I got into an argument with my anthropology teacher. Don't quote me on that. It was one of them social science teachers. And because I had to do a presentation and I was talking about the differences between how black people talk and how white people talk, and she thought very simply that I was talking about you talk white. Like, no, I'm like there's a tonal difference. Like, even if you speak properly, there's a tonal difference. Like when my sister does her white voice, it sounds totally different than a black person speaking properly.
Just all you have to do is like, have you seen this movie Sorry to Bother You? Bam, there you go.
Yeah.
Here's a white voice.
So yeah, I can pick up like even the newscasters or something like that. Like I'm like, they still sound black though, and I can hear it. So that, like, properness doesn't mean that you don't sound black. What is your favorite tradition from growing up that your family did or?
Well, again, speaking about my best friend who still lives in Michigan, is there's a lot of them. I don't particularly believe in tradition because most people don't realize what that word really means. You know, in the space of like, it just simply means people have done it before. It doesn't mean it's good. It doesn't mean it's bad. It doesn't mean anything except for people have done it before. But the tradition that I loved is that, you know, my best friend's family would go to go camping every summer for a couple weeks in Ludington, Michigan. Mm-hmm. And that was my favorite thing ever. Like, I used to love going camping with him to Ludington because he was of mixed race. His dad was black, his mom was white. Mm-hmm. But I don't give a shit what, like, for me, like, I never understood those stereotypes. I'm like, white people can't cook. His mama threw the fuck down. Like, she could cook. I am still like, and she loved to cook. So there was always an abundance of incredible food. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, I will never not love that woman for that. And also, like, I'm one of those guys, like, my stomach is my heart, you know? So it's like, I get fed. Like, I'm just like, yo, we good. I love you. But that, and it was just adventure. It's like, we had more freedom there than anywhere else in my life. We got mm-hmm. to just ride our bikes as we wanted to go. Nobody asked us where we were going or what we were doing. It was just really safe. Yeah. You know, it was me, my twin brother, my best friend, just adventuring down the up and down the sand dunes. As we got older, we was, you know, rolling up joints and getting high as hell, walking around the beach. You know, it was just like, it was just a good time. And mm-hmm. so, yeah, man, that was my favorite tradition. Like, getting to go camping. We went, I'd say it was more borderline glamping because they had like a trailer they'd pull out. You know, we used to have to sleep in the tent, like the fan, like the mom and dad and his sister would sleep in the camper. We sleep in the tent. Sometimes they would let us sleep in the camper when it rained or something like that. But for the most part, like, we was out in the tent. We didn't care because we was just like, whatever. We was trying to go holler at some girls, which never worked. we was trying to get high. We was trying to ride our bikes. We was trying to make friends, go on mm-hmm. adventures, find crazy stuff. We'd go fishing and, you know, we would do everything we could think of. It was amazing.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. What is a funny story your family tells about you that you'd like to share?
Every funny story that my family tells about me is deprecating.
And not funny to you.
I mean, some of them are funny, but it's not really like the stuff you're like, man, I'm really excited that the world can know this. I'm trying to think. There's one that definitely came up, but I'm like, nah. I don't know, man. All right, this is my dad's favorite story on the planet. This is the story I'm thinking I was going to not want to tell. I'll just tell it very, I'm going to tell it very boring on purpose. It was in the middle of winter. We were going to my grandparents' house to help, like, they were snowbirds. So we'd have to go check on their house occasionally to make sure everything was good. There was a big leak and some kind of leak that happened on the roof that made it so that, you know how some people, when they have bad insulation, it would melt the snow, which would create ice and long icicles. That happened. They had some kind of leak. And then on the driveway, had a whole layer of ice, like just an insane amount of ice. So when we pulled into the driveway, you know, it was just the whole driveway was ice. My dad was like, "Hey guys, be careful." And I looked at my dad and I was like, "Dad, you from the country. I get it. But we grew up here. This is what I know. I'm from Michigan. Like, I know ice. I know how to walk on ice. I've been literally doing it my entire life." Mm-hmm. So he's like, "Okay, my bad. Sorry." I was just like, "Yeah." And so we got out the car and I just immediately just Charlie Brown's feet in the air, busting my ass. Terribly, that shit hurt too. And like my brother and my dad were crying, laughing after all that shit I was talking about. It's like, whatever. We go inside, we do what you're doing on the way back down. My dad was like, "Brennan, be careful. That ice got your ass." Like, "Dad, okay, it got me. I don't care." So I go around there and I do the same fucking thing, the same spot. I bust my ass again in full slow motion, feet in the air, full body, horizontal, bam, hit the ground. There you go. There's a stupid story. You happy?
Yes, I am. Thank you. So, what, like, you're working in entertainment now. Is there any remnants of that in your childhood that you could draw from? Or did it just come out of nowhere?
Working in entertainment?
Oh, that's like, no, like, yeah. Did you have any, like, showmanship or anything in your childhood or, like, working behind the scenes? Like, or was this just, like, you kind of fell into it?
Not really. I hosted the talent show when I was a kid, like in high school and stuff. But what I do isn't really camera facing for the most part. Like, obviously, I have a YouTube channel. I've done some stuff, but that's never been my focus. Yeah. Like, being in front of the camera has never been a focus. I enjoy it, but it's not like, you know, like some people are just like, "This is what I need. I have to be." I'm just like, I'll do it and I enjoy it, but I also enjoy making money. I also enjoy being the person that creates opportunities for others. I also enjoy building infrastructure and systems. You know,
did you ever sell like mix CDs or candy in school?
No, I wasn't that. I was never the hustler. I was more interested in like connecting with people than about making money. You know, I used to take advantage of my brother. When my dad started giving us allowance, I wouldn't spend any of the money. And then my brother would spend all of his money and he was obsessed with watches. And so I just make him deals. We'd be at a store, he'd be like, I want this watch. My dad like, bro, you don't have no money. I'd be like, I got some money. He's like, oh, okay. I was like, look, I'll give you the $50 for this watch, but you got to pay me back $100 when you get your allowance. And he'd be like, deal. And my dad just be like, Alonzo, that was a bad deal. He was telling my brother, like, it's a bad deal, man. And my brother's like, I want the watch. I'm like, here's the deal. And so he would do it. And then my dad would make him pay me back the double. And then my dad maybe stopped doing it after a while. He's like, bro, you got to stop taking advantage of your brother, man. I'm just like, I was like, I wanted a watch. I wanted more money. Where's the advantage being taken? You know, he got what he wanted. I got what I wanted. I don't see a problem. He's just like, stop that. So I'd say that's the only time that anything like that happened. But other than that, like, I wasn't, until I got to college, I really wasn't super like businessy or anything like that. I was just like, I want to hang out with my friends and go do stupid stuff.
Be a kid.
Yeah.
So you have a degree in public administration with a concentration in public policy. Was there an original plan there, or just how did you pick that?
So like I said, when I went to college, you know, that's when I was like, okay, I probably want to do something business wise. You know, I started a company while I was in college with my brother to sell his artwork because he's a visual artist. And so in that space, I was like, I need to be a better businessman if I'm going to run this business. So I was like, let me go to business school. Business schools requires a lot of math, and I'm good at math in the sense of like, I'm good at counting money. I'm good at like, you know, I'm good at basic Excel and stuff like that. But when we get into like trigonometry and stuff, I'm just like, I don't know what's going on. And even more importantly, it's not that I don't know what's going on. I just don't care. I could not make myself care, which means I couldn't make myself do homework, which means I wasn't going to ever pass the test. And right. So I failed a couple classes in college and was just like, all right, business ain't for me. Where am I going to do? What can I do to get out of this thing? Because I never really cared about going to college. I just wanted everybody to shut up. Mm-hmm. I was just like, everybody, if I don't get this degree, then everybody in my family is just going to be like, oh, well, your life would have been better if you would have got a degree. That's what really matters, getting a degree. So I was like, I'm just going to finish the school. I've been doing school my whole life. I'm just going to finish this degree of some sort as quickly as I can so I can tell everybody to shut up and I'm going to do what I want to do. And so I went to my counselor and was just like, hey, at the end of my freshman year, like I failed this math class. I have these credits. What are they going to, I think it was my freshman or sophomore year. Where do they transfer? Like, what can I do to be able to make it so I don't miss any of these credits? And they gave me a list. Like, well, here's a list of the things that could work. It was a short list. And I was just like, all right, what is this? What is public speaking? He's like, it's writing, reading, and speaking intensive and critical thinking. I was like, oh, I'm good at all those things. I'll do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. That was it.
Nice.
All my teachers wanted me to be a politician or something. And I was just like, that's crazy.
Hey,
one day I might run for some form of office, possibly, but I don't think so. I'm not against it fully, but I just, at the moment, I'm just like, I don't see a benefit to my life.
Or the cultural significance of the phrase, that's crazy.
That's crazy.
That means I'm not going to do it.
I'll say this is, if I ever do become a politician, I will definitely speak in code to us like that. 100%. Mm-hmm. They're going to be like, Mr. Edwards, da-da-da-da-da, this happened, and, you know, these people are going to jail now for abusing the power against black people, and the police officers are blah-blah-blah-blah-blah. I'm like, oh, that's crazy. I'm sorry? Oh, I'm so sorry. Yes, as I was saying, I think it's a big deal to make sure that we fund the police or whatever the hell, you know. Like, I will do stuff like that for sure.
Yeah, I feel like what I learned in college is that, or from college, is that I like learning. I just don't like getting a grade for it. And so that's why I have no desire to get any other advanced degrees. And yeah, so I saw you nerding out with Rob Hayes on public policy stuff.
Oh, on his, yeah. He, wait, how many interviews of me have you watched?
Only a couple.
How many interviews of me are there? You're making me go, I've done Rob Hayes, I've done Shantae. That's it, right?
No, because there was like a bunch of drone ones that I didn't get to. But
oh Jesus, yeah. Well, I'm normally interviewing people; they're not interviewing me. Oh wait, there are people interviewing me, aren't they? They're drone channels. You're right. Yeah. Okay, you win.
if I hadn't went to home this past weekend, I would have been like all in. I'd have been asking you some more obscure stuff, but you know, I had to do what I had to do. I got my little questions. Do you feel that you use any of your degree currently that you know? I mean, it could be like some behind the scenes, like, oh, this is what I learned, and this is how I use it.
100%. 100%. Learning about how the government works is extremely helpful in life, first and foremost, because mm-hmm. it makes you just way more efficient at being able to get whatever you want. So it's like, I work with the government on a consistent basis. I get permits mm-hmm. from government offices. You know, it's like, I just understand how those offices work now, how these people get paid, how public administrators get elected or nominated or just get jobs. So it just makes it so I understand those things. But bigger than that is that my degree was very writing and reading intensive. And so now I'm excellent at comprehending things and reading them and critically thinking about them. And I'm even a better writer. And that's the one thing I tell any students or anybody that I ever get to work with or see is, you know, like, you're coming up, like, what is the one skill you recommend everybody has to have? Like, you gotta learn how to write.
Yeah.
You know, if you can learn how to write, even just like understand the basics of how to write a decent email, be able to get your ideas out on paper and be able to organize them in a way that makes sense and make it for other people to be able to consume it. Big deal. I had a business writing teacher that changed my entire life. I don't remember his name, but I remember he was one of the hardest grading teachers ever. And he made us write him an email every day. And I remember I hated him. I'm just like, he's like, you have to write me an email every day and I'm going to grade you on the email. You can write it about whatever you want. It has to be this long, it has to be this, it has to be that. But I taught you how to do formatting. I taught you how things are proper, how to greet, how to do all these kind of things. That's what you got to do. And I'm just like, fine. And when I tell you that class changed my life, like, oh man, he taught me so much. He was such a good teacher. The most difficult teachers that you ever, normally the best one.
Yeah. What do you think you learned from writing the email every day?
I learned, the biggest thing that I learned was formatting in an email is as important as what's being written in it. When somebody just writes you an email and it's just one big blurb of a paragraph,
yeah,
it's very easy to miss details. It's very easy to not read it all or, you know, things like that. But if you separate the thoughts, if you separate the ideas, if you organize them, if you bold, if you underline, if you put semicolons and colons and italicize, if you actually use the tools you have to make the email more readable, then you're going to get your thoughts across better and people are going to be able to, you're going to just be more efficient. And so for me, that's a big deal.
I think one thing I learned through, because I worked in the Urban League movement a lot for about 10 plus years, and trying to like contact our affiliate CEO or something like that. But you know, something I learned is like when you're emailing important people, keep it short, like make it as something that they could just answer, or like even sometimes you just gotta like. Like, for example, if you want to get a recommendation from someone, sometimes they act like you write it and then I'll just check it like, all right, yeah, that's good. And then I'll just sign it because important people are busy.
That's something that's actually when I remember reading a book and saying somebody like I used to get anything from long emails that people would send me because I feel like I need to write you back a long email. And I'm just like, you're not obligated to do anything like that for me. Now I'm just like, yo, I'll get an email that's like 7 pages long and I'll be like, yes, I agree. You know, and it's like, fine. Like, I don't need to give you an essay back to say, yes, I agree. You know, you gave me everything I needed. Thank you. I'm like, thank you. Yes, I agree. This is very detailed. But you can give 5-word answers and still be as effective as a leader than giving back a whole essay, you know?
Right. So once you got into this space of, you know, going into entertainment and stuff like that, were your parents supportive?
Yeah, my parents are the shit, man. Like, they're supportive of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Me, my brother, my sister went in completely different directions in the things that we do, and they supported all of us. Like, me, my brother, my sister were nothing alike. All three of us are very different. My parents really did a good job of allowing us to grow into whoever we are and be unique individuals and supporting us in spite of. You know, I think I was definitely the black sheep. Relatively compared to them. I don't think I am a black sheep, but if you were to say who is the black sheep in the family, it was no question it was me. You know, I just cared more about hanging out with people and talking than about grades and the things that they told me were important. But even still, regardless, my parents still were just like, no, we support you, we love you, you can do whatever you want. As long as you handle these things, you can do whatever you want. You know? All right, cool. So they've been super supportive.
Let's see. So what would you say is your biggest breakthrough in your career, or do you feel like you've had multiple?
I think there's been multiple, but I'd say one of the bigger ones was when I moved to LA. I was like pretty much homeless. I was couch surfing and car sleeping. And I ended up working at this black box theater play for a woman named Audra Bryant, who I've actually gotten the pleasure of working with as of late. I think you actually met her. When you were working with us, she cast you.
Yeah.
The woman? Yeah. Audra, remember her?
Yep.
She was from Detroit too. And I knew somebody from Detroit who introduced me. And when I got out here, she was doing a Black Box Theater play and needed a stage manager. I didn't know what a stage manager was, but I said, I'll do it. The director was really great and taught me how to do it. And I ended up running the show. Not a cue was missed the entire run of the show. And at the end of it, you know, Audra introduced me to a woman named Tyree McLean. And Tyree was working for, well, Tyree asked me to lunch, pretty much interviewed me at lunch. And then at the end, offered me a job to work at the X Factor with her. And that was probably my biggest break, is that that just exposed me to production. That got me into entertainment. And it introduced me to the people who 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 introduced me to the people. You know what I'm saying? Like, that was the catalyst. Like, I got a foot in the door and I walked through, you know?
When I was at the studio to shoot That's Cap, I met smooth, like, 5 to 6 people from the
show. Yeah.
I was like,
I very purposely hire Audra as often as possible. She gave me my first opportunity in the industry, and I absolutely love her. She's amazing. Like, when I first came out here, I didn't even know her, and she let me sleep on her couch. I'm just like, nice. Yo, thank you. And Black women, man, y'all don't play. Like, Tyree McLean was a Black woman. Like, the first opportunities, the first doors that I had opened for me in the industry were by Black women. And so I'm just like, yo, any chance I can get to support and help and give back and be a part of and work with, I'm all about it. I hope you can see that and know that about me. The reason we reconnected was because of a Black woman, you know, Dominique. Like, I didn't show up to that event, you know, so just for reference, I showed up to an event the other day. That's how you and I reconnected for the Black post-production organization on Facebook. And I didn't show up to that because I needed help. It was for, like, helping people for the strike, you know, during the strike and all that kind of stuff. I showed up to be a resource. Right. You know, like, I didn't show up because I needed help during the strike. I showed up because, you know, people are going to need help during the strike, and I don't know if I can actually help or not. I don't have everything, but I have some things. You know, and so maybe I can help. And that's what I wanted to do. So I just showed up, and then you were there. And it was funny because I don't remember how you saw me, but I remember I raised my hand for something. Like, who owns a production company? Oh, that's what it was. Who owns a production company? I was like, me. And then everybody looked, and I was like, oh, there's a couple of us with our arms raised. And then you were like, Michigan. I'm like, yeah, we out here. I remember you, you know.
I saw you at the Angel and Tanks thing, too.
Yeah, I was there, too. Did we talk?
No, I just hugged you.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that's right. I remember that now. Yeah. You be showing up support, and so do I.
Yeah.
Like, I show up and support.
Got to support the people, the folks.
Yeah.
Make it a success, because, you know, particularly with stuff like argument thing, like, when y'all, like, when people do stuff in LA, because sometimes it's, like, too expensive to do stuff in LA, but when people do stuff in LA, like, let me go so they know that LA people be showing up.
Right?
Because y'all gonna take us off the list just like some of these other cities that, you know, kept on stage and stuff be talking about, like, I want to stay on the list. I mean, LA is obviously easy because people live here, but, like, sometimes it still don't be on the list, so.
Right. I'm with it.
Yeah.
You have good questions so far, by the way.
You know what I'm saying? That's my my ministry, is asking some good ass questions. So why do you feel like you were able to be a good stage manager without any experience?
Well, first of all, the director, he was really gracious with it. He was a good teacher, but I think it was because I didn't bring any ego to the table. Like, I was just like, I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm gonna do my best. And like, that's the whole attitude I brought to LA when I moved here. Like, I'm going to happily help everybody around me as much as I can until I get noticed and somebody's gonna think that what I do is worth money. And that's exactly what happened. So that was the end. I was like, I'm not complaining about nothing. I'm happy to do whatever I can do to help everybody around me as much as I can. And that's not, it's when somebody's like that and they're actually good at helping people, like, it doesn't take long. It doesn't take long. Somebody's gonna be like, yo, that, give this person an opportunity. They helped me for no reason. You know? And so I would say that's the reason why. I was just like, I'm gonna be great for you for nothing.
Mm-hmm. What do you feel, what would you say to people who are maybe disheartened by helping people, maybe whether specific to LA or somewhere else where they've kind of been taken advantage of a lot? Like, what can you say to get people to push forward of, like, you can still help people even if it's kind of come back to bite you a couple times?
I would say that perseverance is the most common trait that I've seen in the success in anything. Somebody that is disciplined and consistent at whatever it is that they're doing, the results will show.
Yeah.
That's what's just going to happen. The results will show. If you're good to people, like, it's going to come back to you. It might not come back to you. Like, instant gratification is one of the things that I absolutely love in this life, but it's also, it's a fool's gold sometimes. You know, just because you get instant gratification in one aspect of your life doesn't mean you're going to get it in another. And so regardless how much you want it, a lot of times you're going to have to work for it. You're going to have to work to be able to get what it is that you're doing. You know what I'm saying? Or whatever it is that you're going for. You really got to work for it. Sometimes it comes quick. Most of the times it doesn't. I tell people all the time is that a lot of times, most of the things that you get or accomplish in life, the things that are difficult are the things that are worth it. Like, when you have to work for it, and it's, you get it, it always makes the victory sweeter, and it's normally bigger. Most of the time, you don't just get handed a huge win. Sometimes, occasionally, yeah, you'll get something like, I don't know, I didn't deserve this, I got it. Those are great. Mm-hmm. But most of the time, you have to work really, really hard to be able to move anything, and then you'll get it. But if you don't willing to put in the work, and you're not willing to persevere, you're not being resilient, then, you probably should go get a job working for somebody else. You know what I'm saying? Like a 9-to-5 at some corporation. You know, because they'll give you the stability. They'll give you the gratification of a paycheck, every 2 weeks. But if you want to be an entrepreneur, or you want to be a entertainer, or you want to be some form of contractor that you don't get no guarantees, then you have to understand you don't get no guarantees. And you have to adjust your attitude, your discipline, and your life accordingly.
Yeah, I feel like I've had a lot of favor ain't fair moments, like, because even with my current job, like, we see people on LinkedIn every day talking about they've been unemployed for 6 months, a year, all that stuff. And in April, I had, for the first time in my career, I chose between two jobs. I had to turn one down because I was the top candidate for both.
That's incredible.
Yes.
I mean, favor ain't fair, like you said.
Because I feel like, with the YouTube channel and just how I live my life, just kind of giving away of my time all the time, I feel like that'd be coming back.
Right. I'm saying that's really impressive that you were top candidate for two different jobs. That's impressive. I'm sorry, I'm still on that. Like, good job. Like, well done.
Like, so much so, like, that the people I turned down, the black woman who, she posted it in the Posted Up group.
Yeah.
She like contacted me like, oh, we gotta, because you were so impressive, like, I want to stay in contact with you. like I want to stay tapped in with you, because I'm like, well, you didn't take a job, where are you going sis? Like, a lot of people concentrate on money while trying to break into the industry. Can you speak to the experience of volunteering to be a stage manager and any other thing you volunteered for, and how that led to opportunity? Like, what is the importance of, we are black people, we have it harder in this country, but sometimes you gotta do some stuff for free.
I have a mixed emotion on that. Like, I think that the attitude that I expressed earlier, happily helping for free, is a powerful thing. But it also, I came from a place of privilege too. You know what I'm saying? Like, I had two parents that would help me if I needed it. You know, I had a little bit of money in my pocket. I had a car to sleep in. You know what I'm saying? Like, I had a home to go back to if I failed. So I had the ability to stretch myself out and take that risk. But I don't believe everybody has that. Mm-hmm. And so if you have the ability to, then yeah, you shouldn't be ashamed to be able to go work for free if you can do it. And I think that's a really powerful thing. But if you don't have the ability to do it, don't do that either. You might not like, but at that point, then you should be willing to work for the minimum that it takes you to survive. Like, I've had opportunities or created opportunities for people where I'm like, look, I ain't really got no money like that, but how much money do you need to survive? You know what I'm saying? They'd be like, look, I can get by $1,800 a month. I'm like, all right, I'm going to give you $1,900. You know what I'm saying? $1,900, and these are the things that I need you to do. So it just becomes a matter of what is your situation? What is your situation and what can you afford to do? Even if it is, like, you have to volunteer, then it's like, all right, well, don't give nobody your full time if you can't afford it. Work part of the time and then volunteer the other part of the time. But creating opportunity for yourself is the thing that you have to prove. Like, it's very hard for me to find people in our industry that I'm like, oh, I can hire you, because most of the things that I do are very technical. So it's like, when I hire somebody, it's like, you got to be able to show you can do this shit. Like, you can't just be like, yeah, I operated a DSLR camera, so I could be your DP. I'm just like, you have no idea. What does a director of photography even do? Most director of photography don't even touch a camera. You know what I'm saying? So, like, what are you talking about?
Right.
And so, like, don't, like, overconfidence for me is an issue. But taking the opportunity to say, look, I don't know what's going on over here. I just want to show up and I'm just going to volunteer just to be around y'all. Let me know how I can help. Your skills are going to become apparent very quickly. And someone like me is just going to start paying you for it. You know, so I'm just like, hey, if I can afford to pay you, I'm going to pay you. You know, but that's me. I can't speak for how other business people are because I know some people will advantage of that. So you just have to know your worth. You have to know your worth, but you don't necessarily have to walk in it. You know what I'm saying? I think a lot of people get into that space of overconfidence where they're just like, I know my worth. I'm worth this. I'm worth that. You better treat me like that. I'm like, well, I don't know your worth. You know what I'm saying? You haven't showed me anything.
Right.
So, like, you can walk all you want like that, but walk it that way, not towards me. So it's just a matter of being able to come into a space with, like, that humble confidence is what I like to refer to it as. It's like, I'm humble to the opportunity. I'm humble to being here. I'm appreciative that I get to be here, but I have confidence that I'll be able to accomplish whatever's in front of me because I decided that's what I was going to do. Not because of how much I'm being paid to do it. Not because of who I'm doing it for. It's because I decided to do it. I'm going to do great. You know, that's where my confidence is. You know, it's like, if you can live in that space, then you could be in a, you'll probably be winning.
Yeah. Sometimes you just got to set the boundaries with what you're agreeing to. I know, like, my first couple of years in LA, I was unemployed and underemployed, and I had a part-time job working at a school, and the CEO/principal wanted full-time access. Like, nah, bro, I'm only getting part-time paid, so you get part-time access.
But yeah, I'm gonna give you 100% effort during the time I'm here, but this is the time I only can be here. You know,
right? So what did you do when you first got to California? I know you were, like, homeless, living in your car and stuff like that. But what did you do before you got that opportunity?
I was just helping people out. Like, there's, like, other artists and stuff. Like, I remember I would help musicians. I remember driving my boy, like, a friend of mine. I'm driving him to Venice Beach so he could unload his drums and do performances on the beach. Like, some photographers I would help book stuff and get, you know, do things like that. I was just helping everybody. So, like, I was just doing a bunch of random odd jobs, just helping as much as I can. And so that was it. That's what I was doing. I don't know. There's a lot of, like, random days of just being like, oh, I was helping at this event, helping do this. It was a very random time. So I said that's what I was doing more than anything else, is, like, making things happen for people.
Yeah. Another thing about you that is unique is that when you moved to California, you didn't have, like, this goal that you were trying to achieve. So how can you speak to the people who possibly are like you? I mean, I feel like 98% of people who move to LA know what they want to do. So for the 2% that don't, like, how did you kind of move your way through and figure out what space you wanted to be in?
I was just really open to opportunities and, like, just kind of just feeling what really felt good. It felt great. I think that the attitude that I had was, I had reached the glass ceiling in Michigan of what was possible, and I saw what my future was going to be. And I didn't particularly like what I was looking at. And so instead of allowing myself to fall into that, I wanted to go to a place that there was a chaos element. You know, so I don't know what's up, but I know I'm good with people. I know I'm good at doing most of the things I try to do. So I just bet on myself. And I'm like, I'm going to go out there and be good at some stuff and be good with people, and it's going to be fine. You know, and so, like, it wasn't, I don't think there was a direct methodology. Like, I was consistently going to this church and passing out these pamphlets or getting these particular type of business cards. It's like, no, I was just showing up every day. I was just showing up and being cool with everybody. And I just have a gift for people. I love people. And I just leaned into that. And I was just like, I'm just going to be super dope to everybody around. And that's going to work. And that's what happened.
Nice. You're, like, a producer. So what are some of the challenges of your specialty and working on some certain projects? Like, what, you know, some people don't even know what the definition of a producer is, but, like, what are some unique things that you have to deal with on a daily basis being a producer?
I would say I'm not the best producer that I know. I'm not even close to the best producer that I know. A producer is the person, you know, there's a wide range of what a producer can be in an industry, but ultimately you're the person that's responsible for making shit happen. Like, you're the one that's like, we need to do this. So I'm the one responsible for making sure it happens, making sure everybody gets paid, everybody's fed, all the creative is the way it needs to be, the creatives are supported. You know, it's like in some productions, the ones that have higher budgets, they separate production from producers. Then those producers, you know, then you have the producers that are like the creative producers. I would say I'm more in line with that. You know, I understand production and I'm decent at it. I understand what has to happen, but I'm not the most organized person in the world. You know, mm-hmm. like I think some of the better producers are people that are super organized. I'm a much better executive producer. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because I've been a student of leadership since I was 18 years old. Like, I just love the idea of leadership. I've always wanted to be a leader. I've always wanted to have people that I could work with and a team that I could lead and figure things out and set the direction for them and inspire, mm-hmm. support, and help. You know, that's what I always wanted to do. And so I'd say that's my strength as a producer, as a leader. You know, I was like, I'm really good at getting people to want to work with me and getting them to want to do the work. And also, I'm even better at supporting them in the work. You know, that's what, for me, the true mark of a leader is, how do you support the people that are with you? And so for me, I do everything I can to support, give good direction, give good, you know, good support. I'm going to say it again. Like, that's like, it's a lot of people think leadership is this glorified thing where you're just like, I'm a leader, so I make all the money. It's like, no, I'm in a service position.
Yeah.
I serve the people that work with me. I give them the direction. I tell them what needs to happen, and then I support them so that it can happen for all of us. And so I think that's what I'm strongest at when it comes to being a producer.
So with the, so you gave the definition of the producer. So what do you feel like is the definition of executive producer?
Executive producer is the leader of the production. You know, that's what you're doing. It's like you're overseeing all the producers, assuming there's more than one, and you're working directly with the director. You're working directly with possibly the investor. You're the ones orchestrating the actual deal that allowed this thing to come to life. It's like you're negotiating the contract. You know, it's like, oh, this contract needs to be this. Like, me personally, I help write the contract. I work with the lawyers, you know, to be able to make them work. I work with the accounting team to make sure it's invoiced correctly. You know, I do all the things on the high level that make it possible for everybody else to get hired and be able to work within the infrastructure that, again, I help create. So you create, like, as an executive producer, you're ultimately responsible for everything. You hire producers to be responsible for segments of what it is that is on the production. But the smaller the production, then the bigger the role. You know, smaller production. I could be the producer, executive producer, production manager, and the PA on some shoots. And on other shoots, like, I'm the executive producer, and that's just what I am. You know? Yeah.
You're the founder of Transit Pictures, founder of Camel State Studios. How did COVID teach you the importance of diversifying what you produce?
Another good question. So, I wouldn't say COVID taught me that. I would actually say Michigan did.
Okay.
Michigan taught me the importance of diversifying because I graduated from college in 2009. You don't remember, for everybody, 2009 is when the market crashed, and Michigan suffered hard because people stopped buying cars, and Michigan was a one-trick pony. The whole state, one-trick pony. And so everything collapsed. The entire state collapsed. The entire economy collapsed. Everything fell by the wayside. And that was because we only had one way of doing everything. We had cars, and then that was ancillary things after cars. That's all we had. And so I saw that happen, and I was just like, I'm never going to have one stream of income. I'm never going to have one way of making money. I'm never going to do that. So when we started making content, you know, we had a very specific way that we were making stuff. And then my business partner said, hey, let's look at this, or let's look at that. And I was always open to it. Like, yeah, let's learn how to do this. Let's invest in that. Let's learn a little bit about that. You never know. You know, during the pandemic, our side chick, we were doing for fun, became our main chick. You know, that's just what happens. And so, yeah, it's important to diversify, but I didn't learn that during the pandemic.
Yeah. So, like, man, because, like, with Keep Your Distance, like, even talking about the, like, lighting of how you had to, like, with the sun setting and having to figure all that type of stuff out, like, man, that, I feel like that's
crazy. Oh, you're talking about Keep Your Distance? Hey, Keep Your Distance. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's more like my business partner, Tony. He's incredible, man. Tony Valentino is a gem. He is a diamond in the rough, and he is dedicated to the quality of the content. He's obsessed with it. And having a partner like that makes my life a lot easier because I'm like, anything I put him on, I know it's going to be as good as it can be. So it's pretty great. But yeah, it was obsessive, like getting the sun right, because we had to shoot outdoors while the sun was setting for a show that was going to end up being at night. We had also planned for it to be working at the coming certain time so the people on the East Coast could watch it too. It was like a whole thing. You just, how do you figure it out? You do it one step at a time, just like eating an elephant, one bite at a time.
Yeah. So you're a drone head. What are some interesting ways that you've used drones that people might not think about?
I actually worked with, that was a long time ago. I worked with an organization, I don't remember the name of it, to be able to help map the coast of California to be able to track the effects of climate change. It's like they just don't have the people to do it. So they're like, hey, we have this app. Anybody wants a drone, go fly whatever section of this beach at these different intervals that you can, and just send us the data, and we'll be able to use it to be able to track the effects of erosion or the sea level rising, you know, by looking at the GPS locations and seeing where the water is. And so I got to do that, and an article was written about it. Like, there was some kind of, I think it was on NPR or something. I don't remember. That was a while ago. Wow, I forgot about that. But yeah, I did that. That was pretty cool. It also took me to the jungle. Drones took me to the jungle to do that TV show I was on called the... Actually, I'm not going to tell you the name of that show because I don't want you to know, and I don't want anybody to know because I don't want anybody to watch it. In short, I got cast on a TV show that was on the History Channel and on Facebook Watch and a bunch of Nat Geo Wild stuff. And I was the tech specialist, and they called me the tech specialist because I was a drone guy. I am not a tech specialist. I am not a tech specialist. I just am good with software and technology that is consumer facing. I am not somebody that's like, I'm going to fix and solder this. I am not that. That is not me.
Right.
I'm like, that's crazy. Look at that. Y'all soldering. I don't care. I don't want to do that. I like, give me the drone. Give me the drone that works, and I will work that drone. That is what I do. You know, so I got to go travel the world because of drones on multiple occasions.
So speaking of like what you were just talking about, I watched your My Attempt at Surviving the Jungle video. Was hilarious because you spent the whole video teaching us something we didn't actually know how to do, like tying knots. You were talking about hammocks and tying knots, and you were just like fumbling through the entire video.
No idea how to do it.
Somebody in the comments was like, somebody in the comments was like, I realized in the first couple minutes that I wasn't gonna learn anything from this video, but I stayed for the entertainment.
Yeah, man, like you gotta learn. Like, I, you know, when I was in the jungle, it was like, I don't know how I survived because I do not have those type of survival skills, but I did. So I was like, let me come back and teach these people these things. And I got here, I was like, oh man, I bullshitted my whole way through this. That's crazy. I did it though. You know, I had a lot of help, obviously.
Right. You were in front of the camera, like, wait, I don't know as much as I. It's like internally, you're like, wait, I don't know as much as I thought I did. Okay. Well, this is what I did. You know, don't learn tying knots from me. Go somewhere else. But I tied some knots, so know that that's something you need to know how to do.
That's hilarious.
I respect it. It was an enjoyable video.
Now I want to go see it. That's what I'm saying. I'm curious which video that was. I don't.
It's called My Attempt at Surviving in the Jungle. Go watch it on YouTube. On your droner account.
All right.
What made you want to start a YouTube channel? At least a droner one.
I was on set flying drones, and some guy just told me that I should explain stuff to people. He's like, you're really good at explaining stuff to people. I manage a lot of people who are YouTube talent. I think you'd be great. You should do that. And I was just like, no, thank you. And he was very persistent about it. And I was like, fine, I'll try it. And I started doing it, and it kind of, people really liked it. They started taking off. I was like, oh, I guess I am good at explaining stuff. Huh. Who knew? And then it just started getting brand deals, and I got brand deals and started making some money. So a couple of my videos went like somewhat viral.
Nice.
Since of like drone stuff. So I was like, all right, this is interesting. And then it wasn't interesting anymore, so I stopped.
You're one of those. Yeah.
Well, it wasn't even that. It's just like, it used to be simple. It used to be really, really fun. But then what happened was it was fun because of the diversity of the drone industry. There was like 8 different drone companies making all these different kinds of drones, and we got to do all kind of cool stuff with them. And then DJI got invested in. That's the biggest drone company in the world. They got an investment from the Chinese government of like billions of dollars that allowed them to put out a drone that was so much better than everybody else's at a price that was so much lower that it just killed the competition. And now it's just DJI. There's no other companies. They are the drone company. That's it. Yeah. Just them. And so now what do I talk about? Like, I was a drone cinematographer. Like, the only drone cinema cameras are the ones on these DJI drones. And after they won, they stopped putting drones out. They were just like, yeah, so we won. And that was it. So I was just like, all right, well, I don't care anymore. Everybody else started, like, you know, reviewing, like, toy drones and stuff or doing whatever. I was like, I don't care about toy drones. So I just stopped.
Yeah.
I lost interest.
That's the sucky thing about monopolies.
It's terrible.
What have you learned throughout your life and career that would be beneficial advice to others?
pride serves nothing but itself. I'd say that pride serves nothing but itself. You know, pride can be, you know, it really doesn't do anything good for you normally. You know, sometimes it can, like anything else, but for the most part, if you're not aware that you're being prideful, then you're probably hurting yourself and those around you. So there's that, you know, I think that, like I told you, persistence and consistency are the most telling things that I've seen. Like Kev on stage made himself into a millionaire by posting a video every single day for 10 years on YouTube. Every day. He just never stopped. That dude is super persistent. He's very, and also very consistent. And he learned how to be funny. He learned how to get people to care about him. He learned all these things. And so it's like, for me, it's like, I see the same thing with Tony Baker. You know, I see the same thing with a lot of the major comedians and business people or whoever. It's like, you were just really, really consistent and persistent. So if you can understand that, what I said about pride, and be those things, then you'll probably find success in whatever you want to do, but it'll never look like you thought it would, ever. Like, yeah. No matter what you do, as long as you do it, you'll end up in a better place than where you started, but it will almost never end up being exactly where you wanted to go.
Yeah, I had a high school classmate, she asked a question on Facebook recently of, like, what is more important, the what or the why? And I was like, the why is actually more important, because if you concentrate on the what, you'll pigeonhole yourself into how you need to accomplish something. If you have the why that's deep down inside you, you're open to opportunities of how you can kind of manifest that why in ways you didn't think of before.
I fully agree. You know, that actually reminds me separately of like another argument I got into with one of my previous employers. Like, would you rather have a really, really smart employee who's lazy, or a really, really hard worker who's dumb? And his answer was like, I want the dumb worker because they'll run through a wall for me. And I was like, I want the smart employee because they'll save me money. Like, they don't want to do the hard work, and they're going to figure out a way to get the work. They're smart. They don't want to lose their job either. So they're going to figure out a way to get the work done with minimal effort, which is going to make it so that I can hire somebody else to do that minimal effort thing that they just taught me a system of how to do. It ends up saving me more money, and I could put them on something better. Just keep moving them around to create systems around their laziness. You know, it's just like using that as a tool, because that was me. I'm a hard worker. Sometimes things do require work hard, but if I don't have to work hard, I'm not going to. I don't want to. You know,
work smarter, not harder.
I'm going to do everything I can to avoid as much work as possible, you know, but I'm not afraid to do the work either.
And also, like, I mean, I've been a fan of Kevin Stations, the Playmakers, but I'm part of the Patreon to study how he builds community. Like, that's the thing. Like, to be a part of the Patreon and people beg him to create stuff so they can spend money with him is crazy. Like, how do you build that kind of community where people are like, can you make a shirt so I can give you money? Or, like, even when people try to, like, you know, if anything's going on, they'd be like, oh, what's your Cash App and all that stuff. Like, how do you build a community that supports you like that? Like, the Patreon supports you. The main people that support you.
It's more about, like, what he gives.
Yeah.
He brought people into his life. He let people meet his family. Here's my sons. Here's my dog. Here's my family. Here's my wife. Here's our struggles. Like, he blurred the line between his personal life and his front and camera facing life. And people felt like they're part of his family. They felt bought in to his story. He, like, I'm a narrative and you guys get to be part of it. So here we are.
I'm highly upset that I don't know, because I was a fan since the Playmakers. I don't know how I missed the Periscope part. Like, but I missed it. I guess I just wasn't on Periscope. I don't know.
Yeah, apparently he did his thing on Periscope, apparently.
Yeah, that's how he built, like, that's with the crux, like, with the daily videos, but the Periscope was a next level thing that I kind of missed out on that I didn't get to observe, but, yeah.
I mean, it's funny, I didn't know Kev, or know anything about Kev until pretty much right before the pandemic. I had no idea who he was. Like, I knew Tony Baker well, I've worked with him for years, but Tony is trash introducing people. He's so bad at it. So, like, Kev had been to my studio before. I had a studio before I worked with him. He had been to the studio, and I think I had said what up. But he actually thought one of my employees was me. He's like, oh, you're the guy, you know, he's like, oh, you're the guy who runs the studio. Like, one of my employees is like a white dude. You know, he was just like, oh, that must be Brennan. You know, he's running this. And it's like, when he found out it was me, he was just like, you're Brennan? I was like, yes. And he's like, I'm Kev on stage. I was like, nice to meet you. I had no idea who he was, but then I learned, oh, that's who he is, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, He does shit.
Yeah. Hmm? You do too.
I'm working on it. Thank you.
What's something people will be surprised to know about you?
Something people will be surprised to know about me. Well, you already gave away the twin thing. Most people are surprised about that.
Yeah, that's one of my fun facts.
I already said I played table tennis competitively. That's another good one. Mm-hmm. Yo hablo español.
Lonely?
Más o menos.
Más o menos.
Cerca. En el pasado yo tengo, no sé, ¿cómo se dice? Conjugation.
De pasado. Oh, yeah, the conjugations. Man, I took Spanish for 4 years in high school, and, like, you don't realize how much you don't know English until you have to conjugate in Spanish. You like, past participle, no clue what that is.
I had never heard of those words in English, and I was like, past participle, what? Future president? Preterite? What? Like, so, but, I mean, the thing is, I'm not good at conjugating, but I can get my points across. I can understand words when they conjugate to me. So, it's like, I had a girlfriend who was Peruvian, and so I had to go spend quite a lot of time in Peru, and a lot of her friends didn't even speak English. Mm-hmm. And she was just like, you need to learn Spanish if you're going to be with me. So, she would stop speaking English to me. So, I would be there for, like, a month in Peru, only around people who speak nothing but Spanish. And I felt like the dumbest one on the planet the whole time, but I learned so much Spanish. Yeah. I learned how to have conversations. I learned how to know when people are talking about you. I learned, you know, you learned a lot. So that was a really big deal for me.
I feel like based on my 4 years of Spanish in high school, if you set me in a South American country for 6 months, I'll be Gucci. I don't know if it'll take that long, but I'll be good. I didn't learn Korean after 2 years over there. Because, you know, Asian languages are level 4 languages. But I tried. By the time I left Korea, they was calling me Hangul Saram, which means Korean country. Because I can pronounce the heck out of stuff. I just don't
know. Okay. I mean, I speak a little Japanese too, but that's only because I'm obsessed with anime. I actually really don't. I just know some phrases. I don't really know anything else. Like, soka means I understand.
Mm-hmm. You
know?
Like,
안녕하세요.
Sounds
like you're singing.
What are three movies you recommend to my audience and why?
Three movies I recommend to your audience and why? Deja Vu. This is my favorite Denzel movie. It's just really fun and imaginative. Gladiator, because that movie to me has everything in it.
Mm-hmm.
An epic. Russell Crowe goes off. So does the black dude. That's been one of my favorite movies forever. If you want to look at it, see an epic. That's a great one. And I don't know. I'm not a big movie buff. Day After Tomorrow. That's the Tom Cruise one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that movie's fun. I just really like that movie. No, actually, no. Princess Mononoke. That's one of the best anime movies of all time. I'll say that. That movie, that's one of my favorite movies. I had an anime podcast for 5.5 years.
And oh, wow.
I only gave one perfect rating on all of it ever, and it was Princess Mononoke. That movie is incredible. So, I recommend that. And if you know, it's the Robert Kiyosaki movie set. So if you don't know what that is, it's one of the most famous directors and writers of anime movies ever. If you know, like, what's the movie? Ponyo. And he has a bunch of really famous movies that are just really good. All his movies are really good. But Princess Mononoke, that shit right there is crazy.
If you could choose an actor to play you in a biopic, who would you pick?
Keith Stanfield. Just saying. He's one of my favorite actors.
Mm-hmm.
And
I like somebody else picked him.
He's incredible. Mm-hmm. I love him in Atlanta. I love him in Sorry to Bother You. I love him in Get Out. You know, he just can play any role really well. And I just would be honored that he'd even know who I was. So for me, it's just like, yeah, he's weird too. And I like the weirdness. Like, you're weird, bro. I like this.
Yeah.
I'm weird, so I was like, yeah, let's do it.
If someone was producing a documentary about you, what things would you want them to highlight outside of your work in entertainment?
I would say the work that I do to help others. You know, I sit on the board of a nonprofit called The Bridge Lab. I've done a lot of volunteering in inner city schools. I worked for a nonprofit when I was in Detroit for a while, working with inner city kids to be able to give them mentors from business coaches or businesses, local businesses around there. So like, I always am a huge proponent of giving back. You know, even when I went to Cambodia to do my first production, like I was broke as hell, and I still was like, I'm going to buy a couple, you know, a couple water wells out here to help these people because it's a couple hundred bucks. I only have a couple thousand dollars to my name, and I have no way of earning any money right now, but I can change this family, these families, five families' lives for a generation with $200, for three generations with $200. Mm-hmm. How the fuck can't I do that? You know what I'm saying? So, you know, like, I would say that's a really important aspect of everything. So regardless of how successful you are, I don't measure you by your success. I measure you by how you use your success to help others.
Yeah.
So I would say that part.
So where can people follow you if they want to?
The best place to follow me is on Instagram. It's just at Brennan Produces, B-R-E-N-N-O-N, Produces, simple as that. I don't post a crap ton. I post a lot of stories, but I don't post, like, actually post that much. But I go in and out of it. Sometimes I post a lot. I just do whatever I feel like. I'm not really an influencer or anything like that. I just like to enjoy social media. So, but it's a good way to reach me. You know, if you want to reach out or do whatever, then it's like, you know, I check the trash inbox a lot. So if you're just like, hey, I want to talk to you about this or this was really cool or whatever, like I normally see everything, you know, so yeah, that.
So I want to thank you for letting me highlight you. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you. It's an honor. I don't know, you know, my humble statement is I don't know if I was really, truly worthy of this, but you're going to argue with me. So I'm not going to say that. I'm just going to say thank you so much for having me. I hope that something that I said helps somebody, inspires somebody, does something good for somebody. And yeah, man, everybody should love themselves more. You should love yourself more. It's a good time. So thank you and really appreciate the platform.
So to everyone out there, I want you to like, so I know it's real. Comment and tell me how you feel. Subscribe to Seal the Deal and sign up for post notifications to show your zeal. And I'll see you in the next video.